Hello, welcome to another Pharmacy Practice podcast. Pit podcast has no borders, as we've explored previously, and we're heading across the Atlantic to Toronto in Canada today, and very pleased to have a guest that was recommended by one of my editorial board members, Stephen Andrew White. To quote Stephen Andrew said, "You have to get in touch with this person and have a chat." So on that setup, would you like to introduce yourself, Zubin?
Sure. Hello, my name is Zubin Austin. I am a professor and the Koffler Chair in Management at the Leslie Dann Faculty of Pharmacy and the Institute for Health Policy Management and Evaluation at the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Toronto in Canada.
Excellent. Absolutely lovely to talk to you. One of the questions we're grappling with, Zubin, and we chatted briefly before the podcast, and it was quite hilarious, to be honest. And you hinted that all pharmacists are having a bit of an existential crisis around the world at the moment. I think you're probably quite right. I hope I'm not exacerbating that, but anyway, we'll hopefully get closure tonight. I'm going to start with the hardest question of all. So what is a pharmacist to you?
You really are starting with the hardest question of all. There's lots of ways that you can look at it. For many of the pharmacists listening to this, their instinctual response might be to think of a pharmacist in terms of a legal scope of practice, a definition that has a regulatory foundation, or some kind of a historical pattern of behaviors that we traditionally think of as a pharmacist. All of those are perfectly legitimate. They're probably the easiest way to think of or define a pharmacist, but of course they don't really reflect the wide variety of things that people who are pharmacists today do, nor do they reflect accurately the aspirations of many of our colleagues to do more and different things. If I had to answer the question, what is a pharmacist? I would say, first of all, somebody who has an appropriate qualification in the field. Second, a person who has been duly accredited, certified, or regulated to carry that title in their jurisdiction. But after that, I would say the actual job, the task, the day-to-day activities that person does are completely immaterial. As long as they have the degree and the registration and the capacity legally to call themselves a pharmacist, beyond that, they can do a million and seven different things, many more than I could possibly enumerate or describe right now.
Mm-hmm. I've asked a lot of people that question, and that's a pretty damn good answer, to be honest. When I was asked it for the first time, I just sat there for about 5 minutes in silence. So. Yeah, that was a pretty good attempt at a very tricky question.
I think the fact that people do stall when asked that question reflects sort of a reality, not simply in pharmacy, but a reality we're seeing around the world right now, just in society. And that is that a label or an identity, which in the past was a convenient way of categorizing people, the problem is no single identity anymore can actually embrace the complexity of people who are within that category. That's true of people based on, for example, a professional designation. It's true based on the idea of like a national designation when you talk about trying to categorize people based on race or sexual orientation. A single category tends to reduce things. And the reality is we're starting to recognize that people are so much more complicated than a single label can actually connote.
So if we're playing around with that, another way I might attack what you've just, well, not attack, another, that sounds very passive aggressive. let's say explore what you've just said. So another way of approaching that would be to ask you, do you think we are witnessing the death of the expert?
Oh, very interesting question. I don't think we're witnessing the death of the expert. What I think we're seeing is a monumental evolution in our understanding of what expertise is. I also think that we as individuals who historically perhaps have thought of ourselves as being some sorts of expert, we're clinging tenaciously to a view of expertise that is probably not shared widely in society any longer. And that kind of disconnect is difficult. It's just psychologically difficult for us to reconcile that and to see ourselves as the people we would like to see ourselves as, because society's view of expertise is evolving so rapidly.
It's fascinating, isn't it? I do wonder, not bringing it back to pharmacy really, but do people feel, around that expert question, do people fear the impotence of losing their, in inverted commas, expert status that they have conveniently held based on the groups that you described in your first answer that have formed over time?
Yep, absolutely. For many people, expertise, professional designation, professional title is a really important part of their self-identity, how they see themselves. We invest a lot of time and energy, money and effort in becoming people who have titles and people who are experts. And as a result, we can reasonably expect that we're going to coast off those fumes in a positive way for years to come. I invested all this time and energy to become this thing. Now it's time for me to rest and just live on those laurels for a while. Unfortunately, it's not that clear cut anymore. And that notion that we can rest on the laurels of a designation or a title or a degree or that kind of status is difficult. Yet we cling tenaciously to it and try very hard to reinforce it. But I fear that's kind of a losing battle.
It is, isn't it? It's a slippery slope, and people people fear that, actually. And that's driving, just my personal opinion, but I think, and maybe extrapolate it back to pharmacy, maybe it's driving their own behaviours, maybe it's actually limiting progression. How do you see technology fitting with what we've just discussed?
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it. We all know that with the proliferation of technology, access to expert level knowledge is now universal. Any reasonably educated person can come up to speed very quickly on any element of pharmaceutical knowledge, and with a minimal amount of time and energy. And then if you add into that, if you're a person, let's say, who happens to be taking a drug personally, or suffering from an illness, or experiencing a disease, now you actually have an incentive to become an expert in that, as well as unlimited access to that information. There's no way that an average pharmacist or healthcare professional who doesn't have that personal motivation to acquire expertise in that disease state area can actually keep up any longer. And that's been a big driver for loss of professional status, not simply in pharmacy, but across the health professions.
Fascinating. And I was, again, we were talking briefly before, and I was describing an article that you were involved in back in 2010 around the perceptions of pharmacists and how they perceive their abilities and stuff like that. This is the bit I'm really interested in. Could you describe what the professional culture is in pharmacy at the moment?
Yep.
I mean, globally or locally, if it's easier for you to describe Canada, go for it.
Yep. The article you refer to was an attempt to distill a broad literature that examined pharmacy culture, pharmacists' traits, and pharmacists' behaviors, particularly in the context of an evolving scope of practice. And we're seeing that in many countries in the world, not the least of which, of course, where Scotland is an international leader in this area. What this literature tells us is there are several fairly stable traits that most, not all, but certainly most pharmacists demonstrate. And when you get a group of people where most people within that group demonstrate certain traits, it starts to shape culture. And in turn, that culture starts to affect those who don't have those traits. Some of the traits that we were able to identify included a strong aversion to taking risks, a very low tolerance for ambiguity and difficulty in actually doing anything in information imperfect environments. Another very strong trait that we uncovered is a very strong need to be liked, a desire to avoid conflict. These kinds of things, when they're assembled across a large group of people, this is how a culture starts to take shape. These are the behaviors and personality propensities that are considered quote unquote normal within our field. Those who don't quite fit that box somehow don't quite fit then in our culture. And as a result, they may feel a need to either leave our profession or behave in a way that is so atypical for our profession, they are not seen any longer to be part of our club.
So do you think pharmacists, this is a rather general question, do you think pharmacists are their own worst enemy in terms of progressing what they can do and achieve?
So to me, that's a very interesting question, because the way you framed the question assumes that professional evolution towards a very clinical, patient-focused kind of model of practice is what is right and good and natural and expected.
I've given away my unconscious bias.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that that's right or wrong, or I disagree or agree with it, but that is certainly the general sort of perspective, I would say, certainly educators, regulators, professional associations take. The interesting thing to me there is that that leaves extraordinarily little space for individuals who perhaps don't feel that way. Let me give you a personal example. I am old enough to have graduated and qualified as a pharmacist at a time where pharmacists provided minimal education to patients, were rarely asked to consult to physicians about optimal prescribing decisions, certainly never immunized, and certainly would never have the audacity to independently prescribe. My 18-year-old self that selected pharmacy as a field liked the idea of knowing a lot about medications, but actually particularly liked the idea that nobody ever expected me to touch patients. Nobody ever expected me to actually look in people's mouths or take a blood pressure or do anything or inject people. To this day, I don't particularly like getting injections. I couldn't ever imagine giving somebody an injection. The reality is many people are attracted to pharmacy because it has historically been a hands-off healthcare profession. You know a lot of stuff, but you don't need to take a lot of responsibility. In a relatively short period of time, that whole equation has been upended. And well-intentioned regulators and professional advocacy groups and educators are now saying, no, pharmacists, you should be giving flu jabs. No, pharmacists, you should be touching patients and taking blood pressures and looking in people's mouths. No, pharmacists, you should be stepping up to the plate and taking responsibility. The idea that the foundational trait of aversion to touching people, interacting with people who aren't well, an aversion to taking responsibility in information ambiguous situations, that's not something that just goes away overnight because someone allows you to suddenly become a prescriber. What does go away is your ability to talk about it publicly, because as the expectations have changed, a very large number of people in our profession have suddenly had to go quiet, have suddenly had to say, yeah, I think we should do this. But if you look at their actual day-to-day behaviors in practice, they're voting with their feet, and they're not clearly quite enamored of all of the great and wonderful activities pharmacists are able to do. And they're really not stepping up to the plate with the speed and in the full way that you might expect.
Really, and it's so interesting talking to you, sir, but Steve Andrew was right. Your comments are very insightful.
Really, Stephen Andrew owes both of us a beer at some point.
I think possibly. But off the back of what you've just said, I have to confess, right? So I'm 11, 12 years into my career. Mm-hmm. I've worked in retail pharmacy. I started off, it just shows you how quickly things have changed, really, because I started off dispensing.
Okay.
And, you know, like you, there wasn't much vaccination services around at that time. Independent prescribing had just come on the scene. Anyway, I progressed to become an independent prescriber, went down the route that you have just described, that, you know, well-meaning advocacy groups have advocated for, the need for pharmacists to do more, let's call it stuff, right?
Right.
But here's an interesting sort of take on that. And I find myself in my career sort of stopping a minute and thinking, just because I'm being told to do this, is it the right direction for us collectively? And, you know, there's a few questions within that. So who's driving it? What's driving it? It must be money.
Yeah.
But the original call to action around pharmaceutical care by Hepler and Strand back in 1990, of course, was around medication safety, wasn't it?
Right.
So the question off the back of that is, do you think pharmacists should actually just do what we're good at? Because that's my assumption there, is that perhaps that's where our real value lies.
Interesting. So the philosopher Kenneth Burke once said, every way of seeing something is equally a way of not seeing something else. And I think what he means by that is that human beings tend to think in binary or mutually exclusive or either or terms. Currently, as you pointed out, the fashion is to say that the good pharmacist is this clinical hero, somebody who is immunizing and prescribing and making independent decisions and advising prescribers and blah, 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 blah. And everybody else who doesn't fit into that mold is bad or imperfect or incomplete or dragging us down or holding us back. We have conceptualized our field in a strangely narrow way that prioritizes one way of being a pharmacist at the expense of all others. Intellectually, we know it's all well and good to be a prescriber, but unless you actually have a safe distribution system, unless you have a supply chain that you can ensure the integrity of the products, unless you have a viable business model that allows for the ongoing practice of pharmacy, all of these things contribute immeasurably to this overall success of the profession, yet we have cottoned on to only one way of being a pharmacist as being the right way, and actually devalued so many other ways of being a pharmacist. One of the things I think that's really important, especially when you ask the question, what does it mean to be a pharmacist, is to recognize that there are lots of ways of being a pharmacist. There are lots of ways of being Canadian. Not every Canadian loves playing ice hockey, loves skiing, and loves the snow. A good many of my compatriots every November fly to Florida in the United States and come back in March because they hate the winter. That doesn't make them any less Canadian than the person who likes to ski. But we have this view of pharmacists, we have this view of people that they have to adhere to some kind of almost a litmus test, an allegiance test as to what makes for a good pharmacist. What I would suggest is that if we can broaden our thinking and say that lots of people contribute in lots of ways to our profession, all of them are important, but they are different. And try to avoid the temptation to differentially value or prioritize one way at the expense of others.
It's a difficult sort of question to ask, but where does that restriction, like possibly self-imposed restriction, come from, do you think? Who's driving that?
Well, so this is actually a very interesting question. Feel free to hit the stop button on the recording at any time, because this perhaps starts to get to a little bit of a dark place that maybe few of us are willing to explicitly acknowledge.
That's exactly where I want to go. Let's do it.
What I would actually suggest is, and there's some work that that my research group has done in the past that has actually explored this issue, that a lot of it has to do with a fundamental tension and an unreconciled, perhaps psychological battle that many pharmacists have personally based on our relationship to physicians. Many years ago, my research group did a study that examined the experiences of pharmacists who had become physicians. So these are individuals who started out their professional career as pharmacists and had then eventually gone back to medical school and become physicians. And as this study evolved, there's a sort of separate reason for looking at this study, trying to examine interprofessional practice. But one of the themes that really emerged from this is a somewhat fraught psychological relationship many pharmacists have with their physician colleagues that reflects perhaps some kind of difficulty that perhaps some of us have with our own professional choice. One of the things that we know in your country and in my country is that the process of qualifying as a professional is the equivalent of living on Lord of the Flies Island. It is incredibly competitive. People are jockeying for every grade in every course in order to have the best possible transcript to select the best possible program they can enter. The other thing that we know is that intellectually, the differences between different professions are vanishingly small when it comes to their intellectual capacity, yet society brutally and ruthlessly ranks certain professions in a hierarchical order. Many, certainly not all, but many pharmacists, I believe, have some kind of a, for want of a better term, inferiority complex about their professional choice. This is an inferiority complex that's manifested through the educational process, that is reinforced through professional socialization and through hierarchies that are established through public health systems like the National Health Service. This inferiority complex, I think, fundamentally shapes our behaviors, but also informs many of our subconscious desires for these seemingly far more sexy, clinical, doctor-like roles.
You've said the C word, Zubin. Clinical. Carry on.
I have to stop myself and say, good heavens, what have I said? But I think that complex psychology is something we're not very willing to or able to acknowledge. But that desire for doctor-like roles, I think, is something we need to explicitly confront. There is nothing inherently superior or inferior about any job anybody does. We label certain roles as being better, with a higher status. Society pays certain people more for certain jobs than other jobs. But for some reason, many pharmacists will allow that status awareness to actually become more of a personal affront. And I think it sort of shapes the prioritizing of clinical roles above all other important contributions that pharmacists make in a very subconscious way, and not in a way that we can actually politely discuss with one another.
And it begs the question, you know, why the obsession to try and be a chameleon and be, let's say, clinical, whatever that means, and let's say be prescribers and do all that stuff, actually, rather than do what we're really good at?
Yep. Or even beyond what we're really good at, what we want to do. So one thing that is particularly demonized right now within the pharmacy community is the notion that pharmacy is a business. We have a lot of literature and a lot of people talking about, oh, it's fundamentally incompatible to be both a business person and a healthcare professional. But this notion that somehow business is a dirty word, that running a viable and profitable healthcare enterprise like a pharmacy is antithetical to delivering good quality service and care, that's a message many of us have just subconsciously absorbed. We are, by demonizing and marginalizing those among us who want to be good business people, who actually have the talent and skill and interest to run a business, are we not actually depriving our own community of a valuable skill set that could actually do so much more for us if, instead of trying to push it away and pretend it isn't there, why not embrace it and say, how can you enrich our whole profession? If we say, you have a lot to contribute as a business person. You, if you're a detail-oriented person and you just love to dispense, what's wrong with that? If you're the kind of person who does great record keeping, what's wrong with that? The problem is, again, every way of seeing is also a way of not seeing something else. And if we dismiss the historical foundations of our profession, if we demonize certain things, we're actually pushing away an important skill set and an important number of people who should and could contribute to our profession. And in the longer run, that impoverishes us, both as individuals and as a professional community.
I think I agree on the business thing. I mean, I speak as someone who's started, I mean, pharmacy and practice is a business that that now employ, you know, I'm very proud to say I employ my wife and I'm employed full time in it now, apart from the odd locum that I do. And well, I suppose my outlook on life in general is one of moderation, and you know, my grandfather was a Presbyterian minister, so there was sort of influences in my family to sort of pick the middle ground and you know, be a moderating influence, and that's coming through in my professional life, I like to think. Yeah. And I think the same in business. So let's assume business is honest, which is not always the case, as is the case in all walks of life.
That's a separate issue, of course. Yep.
Yes. Yeah. If we assume it's honest, what I've learned around starting a business and running it reasonably successfully so far, touch wood, is that it drives the need for the business owner to add value.
Yeah.
It drives the need for the business owner to act with integrity. And just generally, look, to summarize that, it just generally drives you to be a good person and do your best for your customers on the most simplistic level.
And could I add to that? It also drives a need for something all healthcare systems are looking for, and that's actually efficiency, cost effectiveness, responsible stewardship. What pharmacists with a business orientation could contribute to the notion of responsible stewardship of scarce healthcare resources. Why are we encumbering them by devaluing that role within our profession, when arguably very few other health professions have that as such an important part of our history and our present reality?
I want to go back to the procrastinating perfectionism, because that is a very interesting term that that you mentioned earlier on, and it talks to something very deep inside my professional identity. So, you know, that's why I find it interesting. It seems to have resonated. I mean, particularly in two sort of stages in my career. One, when I qualified first and I was going through that initial Dunning-Kruger, or the first of many Dunning-Kruger curves, you know. The second one was when I qualified as a prescriber. And I guess the reason for bringing this up is in to kind of selfishly bring the chat around to the UK a wee bit. A lot of pharmacists are being drafted into general practice and support doctors and work as part of multidisciplinary teams and so on, which is particularly interesting based on what you just said about the potential demise and undermining of the business or retail side of community pharmacy. But I went through that feeling of what you term procrastinating perfectionism, and another thing you mentioned was the tolerance of ambiguity. And I, as a pharmacist being a prescriber, my tolerance for ambiguity was absolutely negligible. But when I sort of, well, in the 3 years that I was working with my general practice colleagues, the GPs and even nurses are much more okay with ambiguity. One phrase that was used a lot was safety netting. You know, if you safety net, it'll be okay. Did you say, you know, GPs when they were coaching me would often say, well, did you say, you know, what was your safety netting statement? What was your worsening statement? And if that was okay, then it was okay. Come back in a day or two, or if X, Y, and Z happens, you know, come back and see us. So what, maybe an unfair question because you're not medically trained, but what do you think it is about a medic's training that makes them okay with not being perfect all the time?
Right. Okay. So before I answer the question about their training, I would suggest that there is probably actually something foundationally different about the kind of person who goes into medicine versus the kind of person that goes into pharmacy. And it's not just about A-level marks. We have some emerging evidence that uses something called the Big Five theory to establish that there are some meaningfully differences between pharmacy students and medical students on their first day of school. So before they've begun their professional education and professional socialization process, there are some measurable differences in Big Five personality traits between these two groups. And a couple of traits in particular that stand out. The first one is agreeableness. The Big Five personality trait of agreeableness can sometimes be best understood as where do you fall when you're in a situation where you have the choice of either being liked or being right, which one will you select in a situation where you cannot be both? And on this dimension, you will see that even before they start their pharmacy education, those who have selected pharmacy as a career fall much more towards being liked, whereas those who select medicine as a career before they've even begun their medical education are more likely to select being right. That difference on the agreeableness dimension has some fairly important knock-on consequences in terms of behavior. The other area that you tend to see some differences, not as profound as the agreeableness difference, but another dimension where you see some measurable difference is in the Big Five dimension of conscientiousness. Conscientiousness refers to your psychological comfort around the value of rules and the way you internalize and use rules to guide your behavior. Because as we know, there are some people who view rules as requirements and some people who view rules as guidelines that may or may not be applicable to them at all times. And from that perspective, along that Big Five personality dimension, pharmacy students tend to be more conscientious than medical students. When you have that intersection of differences around agreeableness and conscientiousness, this provides a fertile arena within which the difference you identify around tolerance for ambiguity starts to emerge. When you actually have a strong belief in rules, you have a psychological or a mental model that there is always a right answer to everything. When you don't, when you have somewhat less of a conscientious orientation, you don't necessarily believe that there is always a right answer. You actually have greater psychological comfort with something psychologists refer to as least worst alternatives, as opposed to absolutely right answers. So while we can get to the education side of things shortly, but I would suggest that from the get-go, our personality traits, the larger number of pharmacy students who tend to score higher on conscientiousness and higher on agreeableness than their medical student colleagues, sets us up for some of this so-called procrastinating perfectionism problem that you've addressed. Worse, when they get into school, how we teach our students actually reinforces that trait. There's sort of a very long and interesting literature in the area of clinical reasoning. And it's probably a little bit too much to go through in this podcast, but I'd be happy to come back and do another podcast on clinical decision-making and clinical reasoning from a psychological perspective. But it is absolutely clear that pharmacy education and medical education, and in fact, medical education is different than almost every other health professional education, actually sets students up for greater comfort with ambiguity. And then that further gets reinforced through professional socialization, role modeling, mentoring, and simply day-to-day observation of what the culture of each of those professions are. The question of sort of what makes us procrastinating perfectionists then is complicated, but there are many factors that lead to it, starting with our personalities, continuing with the education that we receive, reinforced by the broader culture in which our professions are practiced, and ultimately by those other members of our profession that we interact with and see.
What tactics in the medical training help improve that level of comfort with ambiguity? Like, what tactical sort of, is it supervised training, you know, is it repetitive learning? What sort of tactical learning activities help with that, do you feel?
So you will forgive me then. The analogy that I would use, again, you'll forgive me because I'm going to have to use a Canadian analogy for you, and that is an ice hockey example. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure there are many Scottish children who learn to play ice hockey, but for those who have never learned how to play ice hockey, you may or may not know that there is an enormous controversy in this country in terms of how should you teach children how to play ice hockey. When I was a youngster learning the game, the way that you were taught to play ice hockey was, first you have to learn how to skate properly. You learn how to skate forwards and backwards. Then you learn how to handle a stick. Then you learn to work with a puck. And then you learn to do things in a way that you learn to pass to other players. The point of this form of learning was that you should never waste a shot on goal. The idea is you spend a lot of time focused on the fundamentals, and you spend a lot of time setting up the perfect opportunity to shoot the puck, and you only shoot the puck when you have a very strong expectation that you can score a goal. Why? Because once you've shot the puck, you have lost control of it, the opposition can get control of it, so you do not want to waste your shots. That was a sort of a traditional way of learning ice hockey. It emphasized preparation, rehearsal, and repetition, and most importantly, conserving your shots for that one magical moment where you had an extraordinarily high likelihood of scoring a goal. Today, and increasingly, there is a recognition that that's completely backwards. And so today, many teachers of the game will say the best way to score a goal is to try. And so rather than spending all of your time and energy trying to set up the perfect opportunity, you just keep shooting. 90% of your shots will be wasted, but it doesn't matter. Because if you're trying 100 times and 90% of the time it's wasted, you'll still score 10 goals. The idea here is that you do not wait for the perfect opportunity. You simply keep trying, learning from your mistakes, picking yourself up and going forward. And it's that forward momentum that has some kind of inherent value in producing a successful outcome. Pharmacy education and medical education are somewhat similar to that, actually.
That's really interesting. Really, I mean, I was going to bring it back to the business side of things. And whilst I kind of struggled with the ambiguity of independent prescribing activity, as I became more competent, you know, you go through that Dunning-Kruger thing and you learn more and you realize all the stuff you don't know, isn't that right? But one thing, for some reason, I'm very comfortable with in business is failing. And most of business is failing. You know, and it is the puck thing. You know, you in business, I'm okay with having a shot, trying something new, quite risk averse in that way. I'm quite careful with my money and so on. But in terms of ideas and trying new things, and you know, if you said Jonathan, oh, you have to be in London tomorrow morning, or you have to be in New York tomorrow afternoon or something, I wouldn't hesitate, you know. Mm-hmm. But so I find that interesting. I mean that's a personal aside. I'm being self-indulgent because I'm okay with ambiguity in business, but not in practice. So that's interesting.
And again, you know, one of the things I would encourage all of your listeners to do is learn more about themselves and learn more about their big five personality profiles. I would actually suggest that most likely you, like me and like many of our colleague pharmacists, probably do score quite high on conscientiousness. And what that means is that failure has a psychological resonance for us that it might not have for people who score somewhat lower on conscientiousness. When you actually have a belief that there is a right answer or a perfect way of doing something, and if I don't have the right answer, it's simply because I haven't worked hard enough to get to it, that really shapes your behaviors in very fundamental ways. Interestingly, people who score lower on conscientiousness, it doesn't mean that they're lazy or slapdash or, you know, they don't care. What it means is that they have a view of the world as, you know what, I don't know all the right answers. I don't expect to be perfect. What I expect is that when I do make a mistake, because inevitably I will make a mistake, I have the self-confidence of knowing I'm going to roll with the punches. I will deal with whatever mistake I have produced, and I'll just get through it. Those with a very high level of conscientiousness believe, don't waste your shot. Unless you know you can do it, why would you risk failure? Whereas others with a lower sense of conscientiousness fully expect not to be perfect, but have a certain serenity or self-confidence in knowing that when I make a mistake, I'll deal with it.
Yeah, roll with the punches.
Yeah.
It's honestly been real. I hope you can tell by the tone of my voice. Obviously, all my guests are really special and stuff like that, but I have found it really, really fascinating talking to you. Your view on and your work on the perception of pharmacists and how they behave and so on and so forth is really interesting.
My pleasure.
I'm going to finish because I don't want to take... I mean, I could talk to you all night. all day with you. It's all afternoon with you, isn't it? So, you know, now that we've made contact, let's stay in touch. That would be absolutely lovely. Sure. One thing that it's sort of a trademark question that I finish with these days, and the question is, what would your advice be to newly qualified pharmacists coming onto the register?
I'm so glad you asked that question. What I would actually say is, don't be constrained by a narrow view of what you can do. I think understanding yourself, being honest in terms of what your interests are, being accurate in your self-appraisal, and then pursuing a path for yourself that allows you to be the kind of pharmacist you want to be, not the kind of pharmacist other people tell you you should be. Everybody has something important to contribute. Unleash your potential to allow yourself to contribute in that way.
Wonderful. What a lovely way to finish. Thank you very much. And I will stay in touch. I'll probably stalk you. So apologies in advance. And you know this jigsaw around understanding our collective or the cause of our collective existential crisis is the patchwork. You're another brick in the wall of me understanding that. So. Yeah. Thank you very much. It's been wonderful.
It's been wonderful to be hosted by you. Thank you for asking, Jonathan.
Okay. Have a nice evening.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.